All right, did you get a copy of the outline tonight? If you didn't, wave your hand. Brother Spital has some of those there for you. Anybody need one of those? All right. Well, one of my favorite events in the Bible is also one of the most dramatic and suspenseful and exciting stories really in all of literature. And tonight we're starting a pretty detailed examination of that story in the book of Esther. I know we introduced it last week. What I've got planned is essentially 10 parts starting tonight, not counting last week's introduction, following more or less the chapter divisions in the book of Esther here. The book divides into two major sections. The opening three chapters really give a description of the threat to Israel, and so I'll the threat to Israel part one tonight, and so each of the first three sections. In the first major section, the first three chapters, and then the rest of the book, after the threat to Israel is developed, we see the deliverance of Israel being developed. Things turn about the middle of the book. So I've called this chapter Big Events at the Palace tonight, and we're going to read this in just little bits and portions and segments as we go. Instead of reading the whole chapter and then breaking it apart, we're going to take it in little sections as we go. With that said, to introduce it, let's have a word of prayer. Father, we ask that you would bless our study tonight of your word as we examine this portion of the text. Help us, Lord, to remember that it is, in fact, a historical event, that we're a historical record that we are reading, but that it is also has tremendous spiritual significance as we see your work among your people. As we are just getting into that today and some of those themes are just getting introduced, Lord, we pray that you would help us to see how you're laying the groundwork for our understanding. And how you sent these events to encourage your people, whether it is ancient Israel, whether even your people in the church today. And now, Lord, we ask your blessing on our study. In Jesus' name, amen. Remember the time period. It's about 50 years after the Jews were allowed to come back under Cyrus. It's about 20 years or so before Ezra will arrive. And so the king is introduced here. The king during this period is introduced. And the opening expression of this book is basically parallel to the formulaic line of a story in English that says, once upon a time. Now, the phrase once upon a time kind of has come to imply fiction, and so that's not the best way we should understand this. It's exactly the same words used to introduce the book of Ruth. It's translated slightly differently, but it's identical in the Hebrew. And in the book of Ruth, the New American Standard translates the opening line is, now it came about, and because really the first word in Hebrew is and. Right. And an English teacher would cringe if you start a sentence with and. If you start a paragraph with and, it's even worse. If you start a whole book with and, it's really going to light her up. All right? Okay. Right, Debbie? That's just something you don't do in English. And so English translators tend not to translate it as and, but the point is a continuity of history. After Genesis, the next book after book after book starts with the word and. Joshua starts with and. Judges starts with and. 1 Samuel starts with and. And now we've got this book starting with the word and, or now. Ruth starts with, it says, now it came about. And here it says, now it took place. The New International Version gives a very succinct and very clear rendering, says, this is what happened. Okay, I really like the New International rendering of that phrase. This is what happened. So that we understand it's a historical record. Unlike a fairy tale, the narrator doesn't do something. Most fairy tales immediately start by telling you something about the personalities involved. What this writer does is different than a fairy tale, something no fairy tale can do. He starts out by telling you when and where it happened. All right. He gives you some specifics of when and where this took place. He says it was in the days of Ahasuerus. And this first section, the first nine verses, is really mostly about the splendor of the king. It's about the splendor of the king. That's number one, Roman numeral one. The splendor of the Persian king. And he's identified here, the identity of the king. We're told he's Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus reigned in Persia from 486 to 465 BC, roughly 22 years. Now, Ahasuerus really isn't as much a name as it is a title, evidently. It's if you translate it from the it's an Aramaic word. That's the word that's used for him here, not his Persian name. The Aramaic word translates as great man. And there were a lot of kings known as the great. Most of them gave themselves that title. Okay, and was probably the case here. And so when he tells us this was Ahasuerus who was on the throne, he tells you which one. He gives us a little bit of information so we can kind of figure it out. Now, because it's kind of a title many kings would have adopted, and he's doing that to avoid confusion. Now, the Persian name for this king is, I don't even have any idea if I can say this correctly. It's spelled K-H-S-H, if we were spelling it out in English. Shayarsha is his Persian name. Most historians are lazy like the rest of us and would rather not try to pronounce that. And so they generally call him by the Greek spelling that Herodotus gives us, Xerxes. All right. But that's why this king either has an Aramaic name or a Greek name. Why isn't he called by a Persian name? Because nobody can say it. Okay? So he's listed here as Ahasuerus, and most historians know him as Xerxes. I will refer to him probably rather randomly by either title, by either name, but not by the Persian one because, as I've proven, I can't say it. All right? So to further identify him, he tells us the scope of his empire. He says he reigned from India to Ethiopia. He ruled, reigned from India to Ethiopia. Now, again, those two terms are very specific terms for nations today. If you go to a map and look at them, you can find a nation called India and a nation called Ethiopia. These terms here in this Hebrew text don't necessarily refer to exactly those regions. His rule actually extended to the border of India, but did not include India. And the region named India here is the name for the territory drained by the Indus River, which is actually called Pakistan today, which is just to the west of India. And so it says from India to Ethiopia, but it's to the border of India, between essentially the border between Pakistan and India today. And Ethiopia is the region just south of Egypt. It's actually the word Cush, which was the region from which Moses' wife came. She was called a Cushite. It's the region south of Egypt. While part of that would be Ethiopia. Ethiopia is south of Egypt today, and a little bit west. But the particular region to which this refers is most likely part of Sudan today, just south of Egypt. So anyway, the names India to Ethiopia the Hebrew words don't necessarily communicate exactly those geographic names. What those geographic names mean to us on a map today. Now, he says that it was divided into 127 provinces. And again, there are critics who will nitpick all sorts of things. And there are several critics who will jump on this and dispute the number on the ground that, well, the Greek historian Herodotus tells us that it was divided into 30 satrapies. And so whoever wrote this doesn't know who he's talking about, because he says there were 127 provinces. All right. Well, the thing is, he doesn't use the term that would be translated satrapy, and we've already seen that the satrapies were subdivided into individual territories or provinces, and so there's no reason to dispute the number 127. Besides which, as reliable and helpful as Herodotus is in his writings, nobody thinks he was infallible. And he often gets things wrong. And so to overthrow what the scripture text says because Herodotus said something else is kind of a bold thing to do, to take the Greek historian's word for it over the scriptures. I don't think we need to get all worked up about there were 127 provinces, he says here, in the Persian Empire. He describes his throne. His throne, he sat at his royal throne, which is in the citadel at Susa. Susa is the Greek spelling of the city that the Hebrew calls Shushan, and that's translated Shushan in the King James. It's just a variant in spelling. His throne was the fortress or the citadel. As I've explained, there were three capitals in the Persian Empire. Susa had originally been the capital of ancient Elam under the Medes. Darius had it rebuilt, and he had taken up residence there while he was building the city. He wanted to be his permanent capital, which was called Persepolis. Now, his son, now Xerxes or Ahasuerus, also used Persepolis as his primary capital, but he liked to winter in Susa because it was too hot in Persepolis. So he went to Susa for the winter. Usually spent 3 months at a time there, which is going to cause us a little bit of an interpretive issue in just a minute in the next section. This place called the Citadel, excavations have indicated that it was a rectangular platform that was built where the floor of that platform was 72 feet above the surrounding city. Fairly substantial height at which his palace was built. And it had a wall all the way around it that was 2.5 miles long. So it was basically a big castle, about 80 feet high, right in the middle of the city, that was the palace, the citadel. And so when we talk about the palace or when we talk about the citadel, we're talking about that place within the city of Susa that was one of his three capitals. And that's the focus of events right here. So it took place in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was in the citadel of Susa, then the story picks up. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence, and he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. Now, I confess, I am not entirely sure how best to understand the description of the banquets that are given here in the verses that follow. Most commentators believe that verses 3 and 4 describe a huge, prolonged banquet that lasted 180 days. That's certainly a basic reading, straightforward reading, sounds like that's what it means. Levinson, for instance, he says that the long banquet was for the military and advisors. The short one at the end was to celebrate the king's wedding to Vashti. It's mentioned there in the next verse, in verse 5, when these days were completed, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days. And Levinson suggests that would have been a banquet for the wedding for the king, and that Vashti had a parallel banquet for her women who would have been in attendance for her for the wedding. That's an interesting suggestion. It lacks any historical evidence, and so I'm not necessarily convinced that Levinson's hit on the right way to understand this. Another slight variation on this, suggested by Luther and Davis, they have proposed that they actually point out that it would have been difficult for the kingdom to function if all the military leaders and all of the advisors were in the capital for 6 months. What's happening in the rest of the kingdom? Because there's stuff to do, and if all your military leaders and advisors are there in the capital for a six-month period, that leaves the kingdom rather vulnerable. So what Luther and Davis suggest is that there was a long banquet of 180 days that was attended by various leaders in shifts. They weren't ever all there at once, but then there was a big gathering at the end for 7 days when they would come in for the final conference and for military planning. Either one of those or some of the other suggestions that have been offered may be correct. I would suggest that the language of the text does not require that there were actually two banquets, a 180-day banquet followed by a 7-day banquet. It's possible that Brenneman is correct. Brenneman argues that verse 3 mentions a banquet that's going to be described in more detail in verse 5, and that between the announcement that the banquet would be held in verse 5, he tells about a six-month kind of an expo, kind of a World's Fair kind of thing that the king hosted to display his glory. He wants everybody to come to the palace and see how great he is. And so he invites everybody from the kingdom to come. That might explain why he would spend 6 months with something like this and never spent more than 3 in Susa. How can a king who is only going to be in Susa for 3 months during the winter have a 6-month meeting in the capital? in that capital. It's possible that such an expo could have sprawled over various capitals, and he would invite people to come to this capital for a while or this capital as he traveled. He's got this kind of a traveling exposition of his glory from capital to capital so people can come and see him. That's consistent with what we do read about who Xerxes was, about his attitude, right, of his own power and glory. And then at the end of that, he had a seven-day-long banquet during which all of his military people came for their planning purposes. That may be the best way to understand it. That's what Brenneman suggests. And so I've kind of gone with his view in breaking this down, but it's not entirely certain that that's what's going on. I would say that if he's having this big exposition fair about displaying his glory, if food is being served, it still qualifies as a banquet. Not necessarily the kind of banquet we were necessarily thinking of that's organized with events every day for the same people for that long time, but kind of an open-ended invite-everybody banquet. Maybe not everybody was invited, but just the leaders of the various places. Anyway, what I've said here in the outline is there's a six-month, probably a six-month exhibit of the king's wealth and majesty. That's certainly emphasized. He displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days in verse 4. And then, when these days were completed at the conclusion, he has the banquet that was mentioned then in verse 3, a gathering of all royal officials and military officers. Narrator uses several different words for various types and levels of officials. The assumption is most probably correct. The assumption that most make is probably correct. This was evidently a planning, a strategy and planning session for the king and the military, with other advisors brought in because they're going to have to administer the kingdom while the king's away to war. He's getting ready to launch. It's the next year he's going to launch his war against the Greeks, his war of retribution because they had humiliated his father just a few years ago. At the Battle of Marathon. And now he wants to go back and teach those rotten Greeks a lesson. And so he's getting organized and getting ready to go. So he's got all those military commanders coming in to get this planned. And they're having a big party as they're planning this thing. And he's got his other advisors and officials there because they need to know what to do with the kingdom while he's away. And so we have the banquets, letter D, the banquets in the palace. And there are two banquets, regardless, going on simultaneously in verses 5 through 9. When these days, that is the 180 days displaying the king's glory, when these days were completed, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days for all the people who were present at the citadel in Susa, from the greatest to the least, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. Now again, that's not for everybody in the capital, but it's for everybody at the citadel, at the palace. Verse 6, there were hangings of fine white and violet linen. Whether that's fine white linen or not is unclear. There were hangings of fine white and violet linen held by cords of fine purple linen on silver rings and marble columns and couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels of various kinds, and the royal wine was plentiful according to the king's bounty. The drinking was done according to the law. There was no compulsion, for so the king had given orders to each official of his household that he should do according to the desires of each person. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So the banquet's there. First, the narrator describes the lavish, how I put it here in the outline, number one under D, the king's lavish banquet for his imperial leaders, those who were a part of the leadership of the empire. And there are lots of details given here, I think, to lend authenticity, specific things about the court and the palace and the decorations and the people who were assembled. You've got fine white and violet linen tied back with purple linen cords attached to marble columns by silver rings. And a lot of detail, right? Guests dined while reclining on gold and silver couches. Now, the description of the floor is a little interpretive. I'm not exactly sure what some... The translators make their best guess of what these words mean. But words like this, and the King James translators write a little disclaimer in their preface that says there were some words where they decided they needed to say something rather than say nothing, and so they just kind of take a stab at it. And if it shows up only once, and they said, you know, somebody may discover something later that will clarify some of these words. But if they show up only once, they don't know what they mean. And so some of the words that the King James translates simply as colors may have been materials. The only word in the description of the floor about which we're sure is the word marble. Okay? The linguists are only sure about that one. All the rest of them are basically conjecture on what it was. The King James says it was a pavement of red, blue, white, and black marble. But those color words may have actually been different materials, different stones, which is how the New American Standard understands it. Porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. They're not really being very specific. Whatever the specifics are, the point is that it was colorful and expensive. Okay. And a portion of this floor has been uncovered, but they're still not certain exactly what all the materials were that it's made of. In just recent years, the courtyard in Susa, the citadel in Susa, has been discovered. The point was not to make sure we know exactly what the floor was made of, but to demonstrate that the king was doing what he could to put on a lavish display to impress everyone with the opulence of the court under his rule. Look how great I am, because look how beautiful all this stuff is, and how beautiful this house is, and how beautiful this even the floor is. Now, I mentioned that upcoming invasion of Greece, and it's going to go very badly. We know from history. He doesn't know it yet, but we know the outcome. It's going to go very badly. They're going to be defeated. Herodotus, who is the Greek historian writing the record of that conflict, tells about one incident during the Persian retreat as the Greeks were overrunning the camp where Xerxes had been camped. Xerxes abandoned his tent and left, and the Greeks, when they came into the camp, realized that they discovered everything he left behind. And in the king's tent, they found gold and silver couches like those described here. Xerxes actually says that one of the soldiers, the Greek soldiers, were asking each other, "What does the rich Persian king want with our Greek poverty? Why is he bothering with us?" And again, it's just one of those things. Power goes to your head, and you don't have enough. Whatever you got isn't enough, and so he wants what they've got too. And like I said, this is all going to go very badly, and it's only going to serve to provoke the son of Philip of Macedon to come back and get even with the Persians, and Alexander will go to war here in a few decades, but not yet. Well, the narrator is basically making two points with this description. What the narrator wants us to get, first of all, is in highlighting the luxury of the banquet. He's illustrating the vanity of human pride. That's going to be one of the themes of the book. The gaudy displays of material wealth that has no eternal value. And then he's also giving us a rather stark contrast with all of this opulent beauty, and then when Esther comes on the scene, the relative simplicity in her beauty that is contrasted with all of this, the relatively unadorned beauty of Esther that is mentioned as the story progresses. We don't get that far in the story tonight. Well, there's reason to believe that Persian nobility were famous for their drinking. Okay. Several sources, there are several historical sources that comment on the Persians and their drinking, the Persian nobles and their drinking. Xenophon describes their celebrations as not being concluded until they were too drunk to stand or walk and had to be carried out. Strabo marvels, quote, "They carry on their most important deliberations when drinking wine, and they regard decisions then made as more lasting than those made when they are sober," end quote. Herodotus says they deliberate about the gravest matters when they're drunk. Then he says the next day when they're sober, if they still like the decisions, they act on them. If not, they cast them aside. He adds that the opposite's also true. He says decisions made while sober had to be re-examined while drunk to see that whether they're worth adopting. All right. Now, I would point out, as I was reading all of these quotes, I was realizing all of these historians are Greeks. And the Greeks hated the Persians. So I would suggest that maybe we read their reports with a little grain of salt. because they had reasons maybe to defame the Persians. Nevertheless, it's consistent with what we see here, that there's a lot of drinking going on in verse 8. The drinking was done according to the law. There was no compulsion. Now, what this verse means, it probably means nobody was required to drink, no compulsion. However, it seems to be more a suspension of the law rather than an imposition of the law. One of the Persian laws about drinking in the presence of the king that we do know was something that was one of the regulations is that when you're with the king, you could pick up your cup and drink whenever he did. But you weren't to be drinking when the king isn't drinking. So you can only pick up your cup and drink it if the king is picking up his cup and drinking. And it seems what this verse is saying is the king suspended that law and told his people to serve him whatever they want, whenever they want it. Unlimited open bar. Okay? They don't have to wait until I'm drinking. It's every man according to his desire at this place. He's giving his leaders at this banquet free rein to drink whatever they want. Every guest could drink as much as he wanted without restraint. Well, when we realize that's probably what that verse means, then the next verse really doesn't come as much of a surprise. Queen Vashti held a banquet for the women that was separate in her court, for the women of the court, all right? The queen's banquet for the women of the court. Persian law did not require gender segregation for banqueting like this. And most of these men would normally have had their wives with them. And their wives could banquet with their husbands, and the queen could banquet with the king. However, the narrator tells us that Queen Vashti provided an alternate venue for the women. I would suggest that there's no reason to believe that the king's banquet was the drunken orgy that has sometimes, the way it's sometimes been described. That does not seem to be the case. It does seem to have been a planning session with the military present and only men. But it makes sense that Vashti would prefer to have a separate place for the women just because you get all these military leaders and advisors in there. They've been drinking for 7 days. It's not going to be a pretty picture. Right? That's a kind of a rowdy, noisy event. It's worse than your typical sports bar because they at least close at the end of the day and send them home. Right? This is going to go on for 7 days. And so she's apparently providing maybe a more genteel venue for the women to have their banquet while the men are over there making their plans and doing their stuff in their man cave kind of setting, and they're drunk and rowdy, and we really don't want to hang around those guys right now. And so she's got something else going on for the women. Just a side note, critics often jump on the fact that Herodotus tells us that Xerxes' queen's name was Amestris. And so, therefore, the writer here gets it wrong. He calls her Vashti, right, when her name was Amestris. It's possible that Amestris is just a misspelling of Esther's name. But it's also possible, and probably more likely, that when we realize that the name Vashti has a meaning, of course, the exact meaning is a little bit disputed. One writer says Vashti means beautiful. Another one says it means sweetheart. It was probably a pet name. It was probably not the name by which she would have been recorded in the written records. And so it's entirely possible that Herodotus got her name right, and it's just the way Ahasuerus talked about her, as beautiful or, you know, sweetheart or my precious or whatever he called her, that was this term of endearment that Vashti would have been. And so to suggest that this record is flawed as a result of getting the name wrong, I think, is, again, a bold position to take. We now see the defiance. In verses 10 to 18, we see the defiance of the Persian queen. We've heard about the banquet that the king's holding. It doesn't sound like one most of us would really want to attend, and certainly not the ladies. And then we've heard that the queen is having her own dinner for the ladies. And the next few verses have a lot of names of specific individuals, specific officials, probably, again, to emphasize the historicity of this event. Mentions seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus. Let me just read this, picking up at verse 10. On the seventh day, When the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus. Now, let me interrupt a second and say that a lot of the contemporaries who would have been reading this record would have been familiar with some of the names of these people. And so he's included these. Now, to us, these names don't mean anything. They're just individuals that are being mentioned as a historic list of those names. And he told them to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. I'm going to stop there for a second. The word translated eunuchs, did I read that word? Yeah, at the end of verse 10. The word translated eunuchs, the King James translates chamberlains. The word is literally eunuchs. That's the literal translation. There are many scholars who believe that it had originally referred to men who were literally eunuchs and had been castrated, but that over time it came to apply as simply a title of an office. And so chamberlain might be a proper way to understand it, that the men were not necessarily literally eunuchs. However, if you want to translate it literally, it's the New American Standard that does so, not the King James. It seems more likely that the king usually appointed eunuchs to take care of official business that had to do with the harem and the queen. And we'll see, as we'll see later, in the way he dealt with them. But anyway, these are the men that he sent to fetch the queen. He sends this band of seven men, officials, to go get the queen and tell her, I want her to come. And so we have the king's summons. It's issued on the seventh and final day of his feast, and the narrator describes the king's condition as being merry with wine. Don't know whether that's, you know, an understatement or not. I would say he is not falling down drunk. He's not passing out drunk. He's in high spirits from the drinking that's been going on for 7 days. Evidently, the military planning is completed. They're now getting down to celebrating this great victory they are anticipating. Not going to get, but they're anticipating this great victory. And so they're having a big party at the end of this big planning banquet. And he wanted to display her beauty to the people and the princes. And so he sent them to get her and bring her in. And then we have the queen's refusal, the beginning of verse 12. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, delivered by the eunuchs. She refused to come. Now, why did she refuse? Josephus tells us that she refused out of regard to the laws of the Persians, which forbid the wives to be seen by strangers, end quote. That's a little questionable, since we can't find any evidence that the Persians had such a law. Okay? But he made that claim, but other than his claim, we don't find any evidence that there was such a Persian law. The Aramaic Targums make an interesting suggestion. The Aramaic Targums are the Old Testament commentaries on the Hebrew Bible. The rabbis wrote commentaries on the Hebrew Bible, called them the Targums. And they assume that when he said he ordered her to come with her royal crown, that meant that's all she's supposed to wear when she comes, and that he wanted her to come and appear naked for the pleasure of the king's guests. Now, I would say that the wording of the passage would allow that, but it certainly doesn't demand it. It does not demand that. And given the setting and the king's purpose and the reaction to her refusal, I strongly doubt that's what he wanted. All right, I strongly doubt that that's what he wanted. I don't think he was so drunk that he forgot that his purpose is to impress everybody with his glory and his majesty, and it would be difficult to make that impression by making your queen parade herself naked. It would be difficult to give the impression of a man who is majestic and glorious. All right, and I don't think he was so drunk he would have forgotten that. It would have made her an object of lust, not him an object of envy. It would have degraded his throne. It would not have enhanced his image. Maybe he was drunk enough not to have thought of that. But I also think that her refusal to come created such an outrage among his officials that it seems unlikely that their reaction was to her unwillingness to parade naked. All right? I just I just don't see that as being the issue. I think he told her to bring the crown because it was he wanted her to see this as a state appearance. She was coming in as queen, not just coming in to attend to me. I want you to come in as the queen. I want everybody to see you as the queen of the realm and to bring your crown when you come. Now, there are some, J. Vernon McGee, for instance, and a couple of others, have, I think, misapplied Ephesians chapter 5, verses 22 to 24 to this passage and condemn Vashti for refusing to submit to her husband. Pretty much universally, other than that small handful, commentators are pretty unanimous that it was the king, not the queen, who's behaving badly on this day. And I'm inclined to side with them. My sympathies are with Vashti, right? Not with the king on this. But what happened when she refused to come is it precipitated an imperial crisis. Who would have thought? An imperial crisis. Uses two different expressions for emphasis. The narrator says the king was very angry and that his wrath burned. At the end of verse 12, the king became very angry and his wrath burned within him. I was tempted to say he was furious, but I actually think that the better word for this would be enraged, for number one. The king was enraged. And I got to tell you, it's never a good thing for a king to be enraged, especially if he's drunk, and surround him by drunken military leaders and drunken advisors. This is not a good thing, all right? Not much good is likely to come from this kind of a thing. When the king is mad, enraged, and drunk. That when anybody is, but when a king especially, all kinds of bad things can happen. And so I will say, though, that to his credit, even though drunk, he didn't just fly off the handle and start making pronouncements. He consulted his legal advisors. He consulted his legal advisors and he asked them a very specific legal question. In verse 13, the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for it was the custom of the king so to speak before all who knew the law and justice and were close to him. And he gives their names. Karshena, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marsena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media who had access to the king's presence and sat in the first place in the kingdom. And he asked this, according to law, what is to be done with Queen Vashti because she did not obey the command of the king Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? That's a very specific legal question. What does the law say is the penalty when the queen refuses to obey the command of the king? And then he adds, when that message had been delivered by the eunuchs. Now, I don't know whether this is, there are some who say that by adding that, then he knows she got the message. The eunuchs took the message to her and he knows that. And so there's no way she can beg off by, oh, I didn't get word. However, I think perhaps it's better to understand this as mitigating it a little bit. By refusing to come when the eunuchs came to get her, she's at least not defied the king to his face. It's not that she told the king, I'm not coming. She sent back word that she would not come. It was communicated by an intermediary, and so it might be seen as mitigating it a little. So he asked a very specific question of his legal advisors. And I think it's interesting that in answering the king, the advisors do not cite the law. They did not say, well, here's what the law says. What they do instead is say, you know what, this is a bigger problem. You need to write new law. That's getting dangerous. Here you got drunk advisors telling the king he needs to write new law. The one in particular who speaks up is the last one named, Memucan. And he spoke for all of them verse 16. In the presence of the king and the priests, Memucan said, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also all the princes and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. I don't know. That strikes me as just a little bit overstated. Okay. It feels a little like an overreaction to me, that this is not just defiance against the king. This is sedition. She's about to overthrow. She's endangering the entire empire. She's going to overthrow the civil order, the social order in the kingdom. And so he goes on to explain, the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought into his presence, but she did not come. This day the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's conduct will speak in the same way to all the king's princes, and there will be plenty of contempt and anger. Now let me ask you something. I don't know. If I'm standing there, I'm thinking, okay, so who's telling all the women of the kingdom that this happened? All right? Which one of you guys is going to be the snitch who's going to go out and tell them that? Right? And I'm not sure how it's going to break down the social order. Here's how I put it in the outline. They feared that Vashti's example would encourage wives everywhere to defy their husbands. Wives everywhere are going to say, well, look, if the queen didn't have to come when the king told her, what makes you think you have the authority to make me do something I don't want to do? And we all know no self-respecting husband can tolerate that kind of disrespect, that kind of contempt from their wives. So what should the king do about it? Here it is. They advised a royal edict banishing Vashti. If it pleased the king, let a royal edict be issued by him and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media so that it cannot be repealed. That means write this law so there's no provision for unless or until. There is no sunset clause on this. There is no exception clause. This is a hard and fast law. Write it so it's done and it can't be overturned as the laws of the Medes and the Persians. Make this the law that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti may no longer come into the presence of King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. Obviously, in their view, worthiness is synonymous with compliant. But I do think there's a bit of a hint here by the use of this word by the narrator at what's going to come later when a truly worthy individual becomes queen. There is one more worthy than she who will be queen. By God's program, by God's plan that we're going to discover here as we go along on the story. Also, the point that they make is that the women are going to learn to honor their husbands. Verse 20, when the king's edict which he will make is heard throughout all his kingdom, great as it is, then all women will give honor to their husbands, great and small. And again, honor is apparently synonymous with obey in their view. I think it's interesting to see that there was zero concept on the part of the king or a part of any of his advisors of any kind of a loving relationship between a husband and wife. There's no companionship, there's no friendship, there's no partnership or teamwork in the family. Wives are assumed to be slaves or property, that they're to be used for the benefit of their husbands alone and the pleasure of their husbands, and husbands are assumed to have the right to dispose of one if she displeases him in any way. And King, you're going to set the example for the whole kingdom by writing this law. Now remember who this king is, Ahasuerus Xerxes. We've already explained that he grew up as a spoiled prince who thought the whole empire revolved around him. He's surrounded by military leaders that he appointed. They've just finished preparing for their grand plans for the glorious invasion of the Greeks, for retribution because the Greeks had humiliated his father. He's just spent 6 months displaying his power and his glory and his magnificence to the entire kingdom. They've been feasting with an unlimited open bar for a week. Is it surprising that this recommendation appealed to that guy? Okay. Yeah, it pleased the king. This sounds good. It appealed to all of them. I mean, there's little that would have played to their male egos more than this kind of a proposal. And I got to tell you that the irony of the whole thing never seems to strike Ahasuerus. Maybe later. Maybe when he's coming back from the war. But for right now, the irony of this doesn't occur to him. I mean, he is decreeing that every husband in the kingdom will be guaranteed what he himself couldn't get. by his decree, every husband in the kingdom's wife is now going to have to obey them whenever they call, and he couldn't get his queen to come to his party. And everybody in the kingdom's going to know, because he's going to write it out. And he's going to make sure it's published throughout the whole kingdom. What a fool I am. I can't get my wife to come to my party, so I'm not going to let that happen to you. All right? Brenneman put it this way. He says, the great king of a huge empire is humiliated by his queen. In a fit of rage, he's appeased by his counselors and makes a decree that makes him look like a fool. End quote. I would suggest there's a warning here to all of us about the dangers of foolish pride, not to mention the folly of making important decisions while you're dead drunk. Okay? There's a lot of cautionary argumentation going on here in the telling of this story, all right? Well, the king makes his decree, and the wording of his decree is very broad, and it's pretty nonspecific. The amendment of Persian law, as the king makes this decree, verse 21 says this word pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. So he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province according to its script, and to every people according to their language, that every man should be master in his own house, and the one who speaks in the language of his own people. That's very broad. Couple of major provisions here. First of all, every man's house would submit to his authority. By being master of his own house, that means he's in charge, and his whole house has to submit to his authority. Now, the next clause is usually treated as being misplaced in the text. Most commentators assume that the statement about speaking the language of his own people means that this decree is going to be proclaimed in every language spoken throughout the kingdom so everybody would understand it. But to make that what it means, you have to change the location within the sentence and you have to revise the actual wording. If we let the sentence stand and we interpret the sentence to mean what it actually says, then what I believe the king's decree was is that every man's house must speak that man's native language. That as master of his house, he could decree what their language would be. Their language, the language of his house, would be what he said. And a lot of people, a lot of commentators said, well, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, you got a big empire. Why would men have different native languages? You got to remember what kind of empire this was. This empire was made up of a whole bunch of conquered peoples. They came from all sorts of different backgrounds, and they spoke all sorts of different languages. There was no one language for the whole group. They had a bit of a trade language that they used that was Aramaic, that they had inherited from the Babylonians. But a lot of people spoke their own native languages. Now, I would suggest that we also need to realize that ethnic intermarriage was quite common, the Jews being the notable exception. They tended not to marry outside their own family lines, their own people groups, as God had told them they should not do. And so what he's saying is that if a man is originally Syrian, or if he's originally Assyrian, if he's originally a Hittite, or if he's originally a Hebrew, and he's married to a woman who comes from a different native group, typically children would grow up speaking their mother's language. And that could lead to disobedience. Therefore, the man of the house gets to tell them what their language was going to be for the home. Here's what Stevenson says. Stevenson says, in a home where the wife was from a different national group than the husband, the children might naturally grow up speaking her language. This decree established the father's language as the dominant one in the family. This part of the decree was an additional step to establish the husband's leadership in the home and to keep the wife in submission to his directions, end quote. See, while this edict probably didn't change much in the actual practice of most households, what it did is it codified, it made legally enforceable an important aspect of the social order that had never before been the law. From the time of this decree, it became illegal and punishable by law for a wife to speak her native language at home or to tell her husband no to anything. Thank you very much, Memucan, for this suggestion, and a drunk king for thinking it was a good idea. Brenneman points out that this chapter ends on a note of suspense, preparing the reader for the next episode. Three lessons, very quickly, that are just introduced here, just kind of laying the groundwork for understanding these. They're going to be developed more throughout the story. First of all, grand displays, and the first blank, I like the word hubris. You can put power if you want, but hubris, I think, is the right idea. That's a bold and reckless arrogance. Grand displays of hubris, it's spelled H-U-B-R-I-S, but a reckless arrogance can be turned to great humiliation. We see that here. We'll see it again with Haman later. That kind of reckless arrogance, coupled with the power to get your way, can be turned to great humiliation. And even right here, the king's going to be humiliated in this. He just hasn't realized it yet. Another lesson that we see being introduced just in a seminal way here in this story, in this account, in this chapter, invisible acts of divine control overrule the intentions of the most powerful of men. Invisible acts of divine control overrule the intentions of the most powerful of men. God is working through all of this. And related to that, and before I develop all this, I'll just say a couple other things. God is active. He is not reactive in the directing of affairs of humanity. He's active, not reactive. What I mean by that is what we see here, even now, it's years before it's going to be necessary. It's going to be 5 or 6 years before Haman comes in here with all of his plans. It's a long time before it's become necessary, but God is already moving the pieces. And he's taking one queen and taking her out of play and leaving a vacancy for another queen that he's going to put there. He's getting his people in the places where he intends them to be so that when the time comes, they'll be prepared to act. God's setting the stage for what he plans. And he's not using spectacular means. He's using maybe surprising events, but otherwise relatively ordinary events, unsuspicious. He's taken out one queen, making room for another, so that when Haman's genocidal plans begin to come to fruition, God's not going to have to be sitting in heaven trying to figure out what to do. He's got the people in place. He's been putting them there all along. Everything's under control. His program is never threatened. His will is never thwarted. His promises are always fulfilled. He never has to figure out what to do because look at what that dumb king just did. Listen to what that Haman has planned. God's got it all taken care of. He's working his will. You know, that gives us great confidence today to understand that God's program cannot be overthrown. God's never going to be caught by surprise. And he's working to accomplish his will. And what he's promised, he will do. Even though we don't necessarily see how that's going to come about. It's way early in this story for us. Now, we know more of the story than we've seen here, but it's way early in this story for us to get all excited. But God is beginning to work. And we see that even right here. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the record.